So it seems like a lot of what I'm telling you would make it sound like geochemistry is a pretty fuzzy business, that people get things wrong, they don't agree, they fight a lot. And I guess that's fundamentally true. In fact, I think the geochemists are famous for that. Okay, there's another extinct radioactivity. This is not the normal samarium neodymium system, okay? This is one mass down, 103 million year half-life. So this would not be looking at silicate mantle versus core, because presumably neither of these guys go into the core. This would be simply looking at fractionations in samarium neodymium by surficial magmatic processes or whatever. The search for this was started by Stein Jacobson at Harvard many years ago. In those days, there were some rocks in Greenland that were about 3.8 billion years old, so at the time they were the oldest rocks. And this is quite a few half-lives younger than the Earth. But Stein went looking anyway, collected a bunch of rocks, and just looked to see if there was a 142 anomaly. Neodymium is a whole bunch of isotopes, so it's pretty easy to measure stuff relative to all of the other isotopes. And he claimed that in one sample he had a detectable anomaly. Okay. Well, that raised a big, pretty large interest because of the fairly young age, and what it would mean was that there were, that the earliest differentiation processes on Earth were in fact pretty old. So a lot of people got on board trying to repeat this. For a long time, Stein wouldn't give anybody this sample because he didn't want them. He didn't think there were any other labs in the world that were as good as his, and he didn't want somebody else doing lousy work and muddying the issues. So there were actually people who went to Greenland and collected more rocks so they could try to verify this, and nobody could. It's a really, really, really hard measurement. Okay, the differences, the differences are very small, I'll tell you in a minute. So as mass spectrometry got better, as we understood how to measure isotopes better over the years, there was a sort of recurring interest. And recently, several groups with really the best of modern mass spectrometers have gone and revisited this problem. And there are now, seven samples of metasediment with 142 neodymium anomaly of 15 plus or minus 4 ppm. So in the ratio, that's 15 parts in a million, and plus or minus 4. And this is about as well as you can measure it. It's beginning to sound like physics, where if they have something that's three standard deviations, they think, this is a firm measurement. So there are a few labs that have done this. Stein has done it again. And it now looks okay. I mean, insofar as anything's okay. So it means that there was some process, since these are metasediments, they could well be significantly older than the actual age of the metamorphism that had affected them. So it means there was crustal processes going on within, say, 200 or 300 million years of the beginning of the Earth. It's pretty interesting because these metasediments look like things you would see today that were formed in the Sierra. There's very little difference in composition, phase mineralogy, whatever. So it would tell us that the Earth, in its earliest days, was making continental crust and doing things more or less like it does today. So that brings up the question then of what are actually the oldest rocks on Earth. Geochronologists spend a lot of time just trying to outdo each other in finding the oldest rocks. And so there are great, large, almost every Precambrian shield on every continent now has rocks of the order of 3.8 to 3.9. And then it seems to stop there. I think the present record for an actual rock is in the Northwest Territories. And it was done by Sam Bowering at MIT. And that's 3.96. So a little older. And the hypothesis is from the moon we know that there was either the tail end of bombardment from small planetary objects, which were completely recycling the surface of the moon. And we know that from the Apollo missions and the rocks that were recovered. Lots of rocks seem to have been reset at about 3.9. So the concept was, well, on Earth, same thing happened, and very little survived, and there may be older things. Then the Australians went, found the quartzite, in Western Australia, and inside the quartzite they found zircons. These are detrital, meaning they're sedimentary zircons that, like you might find on a beach, and they did uranium lead ages on these zircons, and they found for every 100 zircons they looked at, they would find two or three that were over 4 billion years. And of course that got enormously interesting. And they started surveying just thousands of zircons. I mean, just looking. And they finally found one zircon. This is greatly enlarged. Okay, these guys are like half a millimeter. And by using ion probe techniques, which is an in situ analysis technique, you can actually do a uranium lead age on little spots within the zircon. And some of these were 3.8, some of these were 4, and there was one that was 4.4. So the oldest age, it's not a rock, okay, because it's a mineral from a rock that no longer exists. But it seems like, people are looking for more of these, but the prospecting, I mean, only a few out of 100 give you ages in excess of 4, and then you have to go looking inside those, and, yeah?
How do you get such different ages in the same
amount? Oh, because it's a long story, but you have diffusion going on. So typically around the edges of a mineral, if it's been metamorphosed, you'll have some of the lead leaking out into the surroundings. I'm not sure whether the ages were, or you know, zonally arranged or not, but of maybe 6 that they did, there's only one of them that was this old. But then they proceeded to take it a step further and looked at the 18 oxygen, 16 oxygen. And we'll talk more about stable isotopes next time. But the mantle of the Earth, this number is like 5.5 per mil. And the only places on Earth where you have higher values are typically in surficial things that have interacted with water at low temperature. So it's sort of high values, let's say 6 to 8 would be a sign of a low temperature process. And they actually did oxygen isotopes on this grain and found, I forget exactly, but it was slightly high, suggesting again that there was sort of a normal surface Earth at 4.4. So make what you will of it. They're now setting up basically an assembly line to crank through zircons, just looking for more of these guys. No, this is sort of a, this is what evidence is there in real rocks, you know, not in, a, in the isotope extinct radioactivities. Yeah, you know, why is this older than what this would suggest? Yeah. Oh, no,
I mean, there's a series of really good justifications to say that, that we can choose the bound at this end, right?
Well, it's, I mean, experimentally there are issues, okay, but it's, they're probably not issues that are large relative to 4.4. And my feeling is if you find the outlier, that's not an experimental outlier, but is a real outlier, that frequently carries all the information for a really large step forward. I mean, you have to really look at it, and lots of people are trying. First, there are many labs that tried to reproduce this by asking the Australians for samples, and the Australians wouldn't give out any samples. So again, there are people going to Western Australia trying to collect their own quartzites, and we're not a very collegial group either. Yeah, guy.
We had Major Bonbon when he had 4.57, right? So how is it possible to have water and everything else on ground?
Well, it depends on the bombardment, you know, depends on how active it was. And I mean, I'm not talking about impacts of Mars-sized planets. We're talking about small asteroids and things. I mean, I don't think we know any of that. The bombardment record on Earth has been totally erased.
Yeah, but
it's there on the moon. Yeah. Moon doesn't have any water. Don?
I sort of wonder whether these delta 18 guys are reliable. You've been trying to do SMNG and other kinds of other things. It's always screwed up. And these things get really beat up by radiation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually amazing that the uranium plasma works. But I wonder whether they're that type. If you look at the work that what's the name of the Wisconsin? Yeah, Valley. It's possible that they're not as tight as everybody thinks they are.
Well,
I don't know if it changes the age, but it may change the delta 18.
Mm-hmm. No, you know, when you have a single result, clearly you don't want to go nuts until you get more. But they're in the process. I mean, they're on this. This will be a busy field.
Especially, the inference is that there was water on the surface.
That's the inference they drew from this measurement. Yeah.
Given the size of the grain and given, you know, the fusion landscapes, what are the chances that some PD could have leaked out of the grain and the agents are being overestimated, sorry. Is there normally not 4.4 for sure?
Oh, you mean whether that's maybe too young? Yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Well, I think what we know about diffusion of lead says this is not unusual. I mean, in fact, we see zircons all the time from all kinds of rocks, and they typically lose lead. And you have to be very careful to pick the right parts of the zircon and so forth. But you can get data that's concordant. And this looked pretty good. But, you know, this is all of this is ragged edge. I mean, you're working on the frontier. And yeah. I mean, I'd like to see this show up in a few more grains, particularly from somebody else's lab. All of them.
Even
Potentially, sure. I mean, well, by diffusion. You take two minerals and put them next to each other and cook them at a high enough temperature during a metamorphism. You basically exchange the isotopes. So if you take one mineral that has a 182 anomaly, tungsten anomaly, put it next to another one that has a lot of normal tungsten, and cook it high enough, it'll erase that anomaly. So, and I'm going to talk a little about diffusion in the next lecture, just to give you a feeling. I mean, there's now an enormous amount of data on diffusion rates. And so, and there's a huge variety of diffusion rates in different minerals. Just zircon's really popular because it happens to have the slowest lead diffusion rate of any mineral. And so people have focused in on zircon now for about 30 years. There are other minerals that lose their daughter product at 100 degrees. We'll talk about helium later too. Yeah.
Just given the age of the 44 billion years, do you have water running around it for that long? Do you have instruction as to change, even though one's very resistant to alteration? Wouldn't that time scale change it a lot?
I'm not sure what you're asking.
But you have the mineral forming, the corporate building, mm-hmm. and throughout that time, there'd be water.
Oh, absolutely. You're saying, is it possible that this was a result of interaction with water yesterday?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. All of that, you know, is yet to be sorted out. I mean, the fact that it's a quartzite, okay, and quartzites are formed in an aqueous environment. So, just the geology, you don't need to really go further than that to say this almost certainly came from an aqueous environment. Doesn't mean we had oceans. It might mean you had a little trickle, but yeah, for sure. Okay, so I want to move along a little bit. We talked about how the Earth was formed and what the older things are, whether there's evidence for primitive material, and I said the lead system was a really useful system for looking at, for testing for primitive materials. So let me just do a little bit of lead isotope terminology and systematics. And we'll do more of this, but just to sort of break you into it. There are two isotopes of uranium. And there's another one that we'll talk about that isn't important right now. Uniqueness, and the reason you hear a lot about lead isotopes is because there are three of them, all with parents, and two of the parents are the same element. Okay, this ratio, 238-235, is basically a constant of nature. It was made during nucleosynthesis, and it appears from everything we know that that it was uniform isotopically in the beginning throughout the solar system. Of course, the half-life is a difference, so this ratio changes with time. But right now, it's 137.88. That's not a number you need to remember, but the half-life of 235 is quite short, so it's dying fast. In fact, it's almost dead. But anyway, the point is these two are linked. They're just, you can't escape the fact that these two parents are always in a fixed ratio, and that turns out to be enormously powerful. So there's only one common isotope of lead that doesn't have a radioactive parent, and that's 204. And we always need a common isotope to reference things to because it's really hard to make sense out of absolute concentrations, but ratios make it easy. So the convention is to make all of these into ratios with 204, just as a way of sort of normalizing everything. So then if we do this, just plot these two together, and you realize they're linked. Okay, they're linked through the fact that this is a constant. There are two half-lives involved, both of which we know very well. So this system is extremely well constrained. So we can do, the first thing we need to know is what was lead like? What was the initial isotopic composition of lead at the end of nucleosynthesis? Okay, and what Claire Patterson did when he did the first age of the Earth was looked at a mineral called troilite, which is iron sulfide, in meteorites. Okay, and because it's a sulfide, it has essentially no uranium, and it has lots of lead. So it is primordial lead. When you take troilite out of an iron meteorite, it said no radioactive contribution from uranium. So it is the lead that the solar system started with. Now, Patterson made the assumption that the Earth started with that same lead. And we have to make that same assumption. I think it's okay, but just remember that it's an assumption. So on this plot, so that's a fixed point. So we start there, add 206 lead over time from 238 uranium, knowing its half-life. We add 207 lead from the 235 uranium, known half-life, known ratio, and start here and ask what a bunch of systems would look like that had different amounts of uranium in them if they had started at the origin of the solar system, which we take to be 4, 5, 6, 7. You'll notice this is an easy number to remember in case you haven't figured that out yet. I always need these crutches. Okay, we said that, okay, so what do we use for the age of the Earth? Right. When we looked at this volatility graph, okay, you remember lead was way out here on the low end. So the Earth is deficient, the surface Earth is deficient in lead relative to C1 chondrites. And in fact, if you look at uranium lead, C1s, the C1s have basically a ton of lead in them relative to uranium. The Earth has 50 times less lead relative to uranium. So there are two explanations. One, when the Earth accreted, it just didn't accrete all of its lead because it was high temperature and the lead didn't condense because it has a low condensation temperature. The other possibility is that lead went into the core, lead, not iron, because it's a core, it's a metallic loving element. Like sulfide, iron alloys typically have sulfide. So if that's the mechanism for getting rid of the lead, then the proper age that we should use to look at, to test for primitive materials on Earth would be the age of the Earth at the time of core formation, because that's when you start the clock. With this uranium lead ratio, the primordial lead doesn't change very much over time. There's just too little uranium. So a few hundred million years, you don't really move this point at all. Okay. So it's the time when you first fractionated and made a high uranium lead ratio that counts. And that age from the tungsten was 4534. And that was the age of core formation. You remember it was 33 odd million years younger than that oldest meteorite. So once you know this, or assume this, the half-lives, the present-day uranium ratio, and ask what a series of reservoirs with different uranium-lead ratios would look like that were made at this time, you get, so for a system, a box that has quite a bit of uranium, today it would be up here. For a system that doesn't have as much uranium, it'd be down here. We'll talk about how you get there, but these are basically the growth curves. And they follow these curve paths, but they end up on the same point. And so if you have a whole series of boxes, all of which have different uranium-lead ratios, but all starting with this and aging for that, they'll all be on this straight line. And it's called typically an isochron. On the Earth, it's called a geochron. So insofar as all the assumptions we've made so far are okay, all right? This age, this primordial lead, then primitive Earth material, the silicate following core formation, if there was a box of silicate any place that was a closed system since it was made. In other words, if it was a sample of primitive Earth, it has to be on this line. We don't know where it has to be because we can't predict what the uranium-lead ratio of that box is. But it has to be on the line. If it's not on the line, it's not primitive. Really, really simple test. And I think that even with the few assumptions that go into it, I think it's pretty robust. Okay, so when we look at the Earth, you're going to say, well, okay, well, where are the Earth materials on here? Typically, if you look at the upper continental crust, morbs, ocean island basalt, sort of anything you see in the surface of the Earth, it makes a cloud like that. And we'll talk about what that slope of the cloud means later on. But this is most of the magmatic products that we see on the surface, island arcs, you name it. Rarely are there samples from this cloud that actually fall on this geochron. Now, if you look at the lower continental crust, you'll see that some of it crosses the geochron, and you could, by coincidence, pick up a sample of lower continental crust that falls on the geochron, but you're not worried about that because you know that's not primitive. Well, I think it's not primitive. So that's a really, really restrictive criteria to use. And one or two samples from this cloud that, in fact, fall on the geochron, but there's another test that Don gave us yesterday. He said, primitive Earth, insofar as it looks like meteorites in samarium neodymium, today must have a neodymium isotope ratio that looks like chondrites. And they all have a ratio today of this. This is, you don't need to worry about what the isotopes are, but the neodymium. Okay, so that's primitive Earth today. So there are two conditions that you have to meet in order for a sample to be quote unquote primitive. It has to look like that, and it has to fall on that. And sometimes you get something falls on here, but it won't be this. Or sometimes you have this, but it won't be that. Okay, so in fact, I don't know of any single sample. Maybe Don has some in his lab, but that satisfy both criteria. So the first order conclusion is there is no primitive material that we have access to. Okay. Well, that's a little discouraging because...
So what happens is that one of them gets reset and the other one doesn't, to make it look like...
You mean one of this or one of that? Oh, sure. Yeah, no. I mean, but primitive Earth, by my definition, is a closed box that has had nothing happen to it. If you're going to reset it, what that means is you've allowed that box to be open, so you've already violated the condition. If the box is open and reset, then we can't really use the composition of the box to tell us what bulk Earth is. I mean, so right. So that's sort of bad news. There's another, and again, I'm just giving you a preview of a bunch of stuff here. There's another marker of primordialness, okay? And it's helium-3 over helium-4. This is generated by alpha decay from uranium-thorium, okay? This doesn't have any parent. It's just whatever it was. So the concept is, the higher this ratio, the more primordial. The highest ratio of that's yet been found is in the, we'll talk about the numbers, but the highest ratio is in an Icelandic basalt, a basalt from Iceland. And when you look at the other isotopes, they plot out there, and they plot like 5129 for this ratio. So even though this is the most primordial, if you take this as a measure of primordial, it's in fact not even remotely primordial. Oh, that's a very good question. We'll talk about that because that's really nasty. Why do we think of it this way? Every other isotope system, we plot the radiogenic daughter, or radiate, on top, and the other one on the bottom. The comparable approach would be to write 86 strontium over 87 strontium. Okay? This is the daughter, and this is the reference isotope. Well, so usually this is the daughter, and this is the reference isotope. And by analogy with this, I mean, let's face it, 86 is all primordial. I mean, there's no other way to make it. So every common isotope is primordial. That doesn't help us much. But as an index of how primitive it is, by this argument, we'd say, well, the highest 3-4 is the most primordial. We'd say, oh, the highest 86-87 is the most primordial, which means the lowest 87-86. Well, the lowest 87-86 on Earth comes from Morb, from the upper mantle, and it's we know it's not primitive. So there's an interesting history, a fight that went on between Paris and everybody else in the world, and they would always write there's helium-4 over helium-3, and it would completely befuddle everybody because nobody was used to thinking of it that way. But when you think of it as an isotope system and generating daughter and all of that, you'll find it, we'll talk about this, you'll find it much easier to flip this over. Okay, one last measure of primordial, and it's another extinct radioactivity. It bears on things in a slightly different way. And this is the iodine xenon system, okay? Iodine-129 is made in the during nucleosynthesis. Has a half-life of 17 million years, so when you stop making it, it dies away. Well, if you wait before you start collecting stuff, you wait more than, say, 50 million years, all the iodine is going to be dead, and all the xenon is going to look like all the other xenon in the world. So we have to make a plot There are actually two extinct radioactivities, but I wanted to focus on the xenon and not confuse you, but let's do them both. Other one's plutonium-244, decays to another xenon. I should say there's a fission product, okay, but has an 80 million year half-life. So we use 130 xenon as the reference. That's the stable isotope, doesn't have any parents. And then we can plot 136, 130. And just look at this ratio in different materials. Now, if the whole Earth formed was, let's say, well mixed at any time in its history, then all the xenon in the Earth should look exactly the same. If the Earth fractionated much more than three or four half-lives after the Earth accreted, all the xenon should look the same. Okay? So the reference on Earth is the atmosphere. This is xenon in the atmosphere. Okay, you look at a whole bunch of stuff, it looks like atmosphere. But a Paris group many, many years ago discovered that when you looked at MORB, mid-ocean ridge basalts from the upper mantle, most of them plotted down here near atmosphere. But a few of them didn't, and this was of order 20%. In other words, the isotope ratio of xenon was 20% enriched in 129, which is the decay product of iodine, and also enriched in 136, which is the fission product of plutonium. Well, this is pretty remarkable. I mean, we haven't found xenon anomalies anywhere else. Well, there are a few exceptions, but basically not. Why we find them in MORB? A lot of people have looked at ocean island basalts because these are presumed to be plumes from the deep mantle, and wouldn't you love to find excess 129 xenon in a plume? But these are always atmospheric. Probably because they've actually interacted with the atmosphere when they were erupted, so you're dead. But these MORB are really peculiar. So what does it tell you? It tells you that this iodine, this xenon, was made a long time ago, and you haven't mixed it with the atmosphere. So it's sort of a different story from the other extinct radioactivities. The other ones, we put tungsten in the core and leave behind hafnium and so forth. This one means that the upper mantle has not been thoroughly mixed with the atmosphere since 4.4 billion years ago. And I mean, I still find that just remarkable. So the whole process of reinjection, subduction, you know, we've massively reinvigorated the mantle with subducted slabs over Earth history. And it turns out that sediments and things like that love to have xenon stuck to the minerals. So you subduct an enormous amount of xenon. Somehow in all of that processing, you haven't wiped out this anomaly. It's really, really, as again I say, it's really hard measurement. Everything seems to be hard. There are only about two labs in the world that can even do xenon measurements. And after this initial discovery, there was some little work in Paris carrying it on, but then it sort of disappeared and everybody stopped doing xenon just when I thought it got interesting. It's because it's really hard. So those are the examples of things from long ago that have persisted. Now, it doesn't mean, you know, of course, this sample's not primitive just because it has some 129 xenon in it. But it has some primitive material in it that hasn't been mixed for a very, very long time. Okay, we're going to switch gears, and so if we're going to leave this, if there's any fuzziness remaining.
Yeah, I guess the ocean and atmosphere are basically the same system.
Yes, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So it's hard to understand that, how, because you imagine that there's water interacting.
No, as I say, sediments love to absorb xenon on the clay minerals, and water itself will have soluble xenon in it. And all this stuff is massively recycled. I mean, you calculate how much plate stuff you put down in 4 billion years. You know, it's enough to fill a mantle up halfway. I think it's irrefutable. I mean, I don't worry about the data. And it puzzles me as to why there isn't 20 other labs now trying to do this. But okay.
I'm thinking about something like those in the
interval. No. I don't believe it. Okay, so we could talk about it. Well, I'll just very, very briefly. Okay, there's one 186 osmium. Now, this is not the normal osmium isotope system that everybody talks about, okay? This comes from 190 platinum, decays to 186 osmium. This is not an extinct radioactivity. In fact, this guy's going to be around forever. There's a half-life of, I forget, 600 billion years. And the isotope itself is one of the smallest, least abundant of all the platinum isotopes. You have absolutely everything working against you. You have an almost vanishingly small parent with an almost incredibly long half-life, and you go looking for the daughter product. Well, the reason you care, okay, is because this platinum and osmium are both noble metals, okay. But during the, theoretically, during the process of forming metallic iron from silicate, the argument was you would fractionate these two, not by a lot, but a little bit. In other words, from whatever they whatever ratio they were made in, okay, and that you would in fact put a little more platinum in the core than osmium. So over time, this trivial amount of platinum with this incredibly long half-life would give you a little excess of 186 osmium. So then the argument was, well, if plumes come from the core mantle boundary, okay, and Don talked yesterday as if that was a given, but I have to tell you, it's a given as far as I'm concerned, but there's a very strong vociferous community out there who doesn't believe plumes come from the core mantle boundary. They don't even believe plumes exist. Okay, so I've done my honesty thing. Anyway, so if plumes do come from the core mantle boundary, if in the process they entrain in some magical way, you know, by diffusion, by mechanical viscous entrainment or whatever, some core material, we might expect that to have a 186 osmium anomaly. And the first measurements that were done on Hawaii, in fact, showed a slight excess of osmium 186. Pretty easily measurable. It's slightly heroic, but they were distinctly, you know, 15 sigma, not 3. And so there was pronounced to the world that, we have plumes. The Hawaiian plume comes from the core mantle boundary. It got a little messy because, as seems to happen with geochemistry, they made a few mistakes. And the sample with the biggest 186 anomaly turned out to have some 186 tungsten in it. Okay, so that's a separate, it's just a mechanical problem, all right? So it was wrong. But there are still bona fide osmium measurements in many lavas now from ocean island basalts around the world that have a positive anomaly. So, does that prove the case? Well, I personally don't think so. I mean, what you need to produce this, okay, is material with a high platinum-osmium ratio, you know, parent-daughter. So you look around the world, where do you find stuff with a high platinum-osmium ratio? Well, it turns out in the continents, you have high platinum-osmium ratio. And if you look at all continental material, you find 186 anomalies everywhere. So all you have to do is take some continent, recycle it into the mantle, bring it back up in Hawaii or whatever plume, and you can build this in. I'm being a little unfair, perhaps, to the core osmium.
They also measure 187 as well.
Yeah.
That's harder to do.
No, that's exactly as easy. That depends on this ratio, and those two go together in sediments. One goes up, the other goes up. In fact, there's a very good...
Third trying to celebrate sediments, there's just not enough sediments to get the mass down.
You know, I don't know, because all you need, well, on a global scale, I don't know, all you need is a little sediment in the sample that you're looking at, and you can do it. This is under argument. The principal proponent who started it all has backed off and is now working on osmium in other parts of the world. So I suspect he's seeing the handwriting on the wall. You know, I don't mean to demean it, because if we could find a tracer for the core, it would be...
You mentioned this morning after the punch.
Yeah. It would be incredibly valuable. So it's worth any amount of searching. But... have to do it right. Okay, so who wants to hear about spidergrams? Okay, Don showed this thing yesterday, okay. It's mostly, we use it mostly for the sort of lithophile, the incompatible, so-called incompatible elements. Don't write this down, because I just made this up, okay? I'm going to tell you how I made it up in a minute. So we take concentration of a rock, and we divide by concentration of bulk silicate earth, okay? Or we could divide by, if we wanted to be more careful, divide by primitive upper mantle. Okay, now you'll realize from what we said this morning that we think we know how to go about this, and we have numbers for this. And we then make the grand extrapolation that the upper mantle looks like the rest of the mantle, and you could call it bulk silicate earth. But just remember what goes into that. We can also just be less genetic about it and divide by C1 chondrites. And this is historically what most people have done. Okay. The point of doing this, if you just plotted concentration of your rock, okay, I mean, it just goes nuts because of the randomness of concentrations that were made during nucleosynthesis of these elements. So in the early days, to get rid of the problem with rare earths, where you have even, odd, even, odd, even, odd rare earth abundances, you divided by something that had the same even, odd pattern to get rid of it. Okay. So we still do that. You can pick C1s, bulk silicate earth, primitive upper mantle to normalize, just to get rid of the sort of big wiggles. And then if you were to discover a sample of primitive earth, presuming you knew how to do this without involving primitive earth, everything would plot on a straight line, horizontal line. Some things plot pretty close to a straight line. But as Don showed yesterday, we'll have to change this a little bit. Let me just give you sort of the big picture. Okay, this would be Morb. This would be OIBs. Okay, there's a lot of fine structure to this that I'm ignoring for the moment. I just want to give you the big picture of the way Morb looks, mid-ocean ridge basalts. Ocean island basalts are distinctly different. Continents are yet different again. And you say, wow, how did you decide how to put these elements in order so that these things came out looking like this? Right? I mean, I could have, you say, well, you just made this up. Why did you make it up in a way that it was like that? Okay, it's made up. There are some arcane features, okay, to the way it's made up. But basically, it's made up in order of incompatibility. So we plot the elements to go more incompatible as you go to the left. You go, okay, so what's this compatibility thing? Okay. Basically, if you look at concentration in a mineral, concentration in a melt, and this is a partition coefficient. You'll hear a ton about this, and it's really important, and we'll talk about how you measure this. But in an equilibrium situation, either in nature or in the lab, if you take a basalt melt, let's say you have a clinopyroxene phenocryst in this basalt, and it's hot enough that everything is in equilibrium, trace element, major element, everything's happy. You measure those two concentrations, concentration of any element, okay, element I in the mineral and in the melt, and this is the partition coefficient. And what it means, incompatible, means it's not happy in the mineral. Okay? It's incompatible in the crystal lattice. Would be happier to be in the melt. So if we call this, and again, we need to only talk about little limited areas with these things. Sometimes this is called D. Okay, except when you're talking about diffusion, in which case this might be a diffusivity. Sometimes it's called KD, not K, because that's used in about every other possible calculation. Okay, so D or KD, whatever, it's a partition coefficient. As we go to the left, more incompatible means less in the mineral, more in the melt. So KD goes down, we go to the left. Yeah?
Can I just get the distinction between if you're talking about refractory volatile versus compatible and incompatible? Or what the distinction is between the two?
Refractory and volatile only refers to their condensation temperature. Okay, so that's completely separate. If you have a vapor with all kinds of things floating around it and you start cooling it down, they start getting together and making condensed phases. Okay, but that's totally separate from this. A refractory element can be either compatible or incompatible. It's totally separate. Okay? Yeah. Yeah. Where one is. Well, I left it off. You mean here?
Yeah.
Well, let's put it there.
No, I mean, what mineral is partitioned equally?
Well, we're going to talk about that, in fact, very soon. I'm going to show you the partition coefficients for the spidogram for all of your favorite minerals.
Much greater than one to much smaller than one?
Yeah. This number, let's talk about olivine, erythropyroxene, clinopyroxene, spinel, and plagioclase, just to limit it somewhat. There are elements with KDs of 30, for example, nickel. Much rather be in olivine than in the melt. So it's not incompatible, it's in fact compatible all the way down to something like, let's say, barium in olivine, which is of order 10 to the minus 5. So there's only a factor of a million from one end to the other. Okay. So then it seems pretty simple in principle. If we're going to order them in terms of incompatibility. And this is just, I mean, it's, you just do it. You could do it the other way around. You could make them go incompatible that way, okay? What you need to know then is partition coefficients for all these elements in different phases. But the problem is every phase is different on this compatibility. In other words, clinopyroxene will have a different order of compatibility or incompatibility than orthopyroxene, than olivine, than garnet. So you would have to make a spidogram with these elements. You would have to put a little asterisk on here and say this order of elements applies to CPX or this applies to garnet, and then everybody would drive you out of the business for complicating things. So early on, before we had an enormous amount of information about partition coefficients, somebody took advantage of the fact that MORB, we think we know how MORB is formed and from what kind of a reservoir. We think the MORB mantle has been depleted gradually over time by extraction of melt. Okay, so the upper mantle is where MORB comes from. And you take, on the ridges, you take melt out, make a plate, subduct it, take some stuff out there to make a continent that is forever sequestered, put the other stuff back, recycle some of it. But eventually, you're depleting the upper mantle. And because it's all being done by melting events, it's being depleted according to this incompatibility arrangement. So one thing you could do is just say, well, we'll take MORB and we'll measure all the element concentrations in typical MORB and we'll order the elements in such a way that we get a smooth diagram. Seems pretty simple. And that's really what was done. Okay, there's some fine points to it, but basically you look at all these kinds of elements in MORB and just say, and relative to C1s or relative to whatever. And the lower that number is, the smaller the concentration is relative to your normalizing factor, you move the element over this way. Now people, there are enormous fights about, you know, whether you want to, for example, where to put lead, because lead sort of misbehaves in almost every system. So there'd be little arguments about switching things. The rare earths uniformly go from lanthanum to ytterbium. Okay, that's as they're getting smaller, and that's a simple crystal chemical thing. They behave very well because they're a single element, if you like. And all these other elements we organize according so that we get a smooth diagram. Well, what's that sort of doing in terms of partition coefficients? It's saying MORB involves partition coefficients of CPX, olivine, OPX, garnet. So So it's really saying that Moab sort of is some pretty typical average of the partition coefficients of all those guys. So any one of these individually might prefer a different order. But when you calculate the bulk partition coefficient of these minerals in the abundances they occur in the mantle, that's really what this shape is telling us. So I confess this is a point at which a transparency would be a big help, but since I'm against that.
Does the original listing of compatibility jive with
the experience? Yeah, pretty well. I mean, as I say, we all argue about whether lead should go to the left or the right of cerium. I mean, it's like we can have a two-hour argument about that. But at the level that you guys are worried about, it's completely immaterial. Okay, so what I'm going to do is plot you a spidergram with the partition coefficients. Okay, we're not going to talk about rocks yet, but just so you can see what the shape of a partition coefficient looks like for these different minerals with the order of elements arranged according to this Moab model. Okay, and it'll take me a little more than a little time to draw this probably. But I'll put the elements down just so you can this is what Don said, we have way too many elements than we know what to do with. I mean, part of what I'm trying to do is develop the basis for looking at radioactive isotope systems. Okay, because the parent and daughters all end up on this diagram. And the behavior of parent and daughters is what determines the isotopic evolution of reservoirs. And we're trying to talk about heterogeneity in the mantle. The strongest evidence for heterogeneity comes from isotopes. And the isotopes got that way by having funny parent-daughter ratios. And the funny parent-daughter ratios came from this melt-crystal interaction. It's basically, you know, the concept is really straightforward. The execution is a little tougher. So you'll recognize some elements. I hope you can see this. Maybe I'll just get them to scan this in. So instead of worrying endlessly about my getting it right, say, well, why did you stop there? I mean, this is not the whole periodic table yet. Okay, but it's the elements that traditionally have been easy to measure. You'll recognize the rare earths, okay, in order of their decreasing size. Lanthanum, cerium, praseodymium, neodymium, samarium, europium, gadolinium, terbium, dysprosium, holmium, erbium, and terbium, and lutetium. Okay, and then sort of interspersed in there, titanium, okay? Funny place. Hafnium. Where did zirconium go? Oh, dear. Okay, my favorite element, I left it out. Strontium, lead. Niobium. Sometimes we'll put tantalum in here if we have good data. Potassium, uranium, thorium, barium, rubidium. We could add cesium, okay. There are others you could put in here, but there's simply either not a good enough analytical technique to actually measure it well, or nobody cares. Okay, heat-producing elements. Okay. One of the big issues in what's driving mantle convection, thorium, uranium, potassium. They're surprising. They're all right next to each other, and even though you could hardly get a different collection of elements. Basically all similar in compatibility. Small differences turn into very important differences when it comes to telling where melts come from. And either Don or I will address that at some point. There are some other features. Some of these elements are called high field strength elements, meaning they have a high charge, they're pretty small, so they're very ionically active. Tantalum, niobium, zirconium, and hafnium. These are also in our condensation plot, the really, really refractory elements. It matters not in terrestrial process. So, rubidium, parent of strontium, samarium, neodymium, lutetium, hafnium, as we said, rubidium, strontium, uranium, lead. So the placement of these parent daughters on here determines what happens to the isotopes when you fractionate these parents and daughters. And you'll see that they're not all the same. There's a parent and a daughter. There's a parent, a daughter, parent, daughter. But then we have here parent, lutetium, and the daughter's way over here. And samarium, parent, and daughter here. So on the spidergram, there's no reason they should be in any particular way. But it means they'll behave in the opposite fashion during a melting process and during aging of a residue. You melt something, you leave behind. You take the rubidium out, so you leave a low rubidium relative to strontium. At the same time, you melt something, you take out more neodymium, which is the daughter. Okay, so we'll talk about, in terms of isotopic evolution, how that actually plays out. Okay, truly, I'll get them to scan this in because I don't even want to pretend to get this right. Okay, so
all ridiculous.
So you look at that and you say, wow, that's pretty smooth. Okay? No big jigs and jags. Well, it's because, again, it's a circular thing. We arrange these so that morb would come out smooth. The major phase that controls all of these elements in the morb mantle during melting is clinopyroxene. So when we look at the partitioning spidergram, okay, this is concentration mineral, concentration melt. Since clinopyroxene is controlling, for the most part, the melting exchange with the mantle during morb genesis, then if we order them according to morb, these elements, then clinopyroxene should be smooth. Okay, so let's look at some of the others. This is like 10. Anybody guess what that one is? You can look at the pattern and tell. Compatible on the right end for the heavy rare earths. Pardon? No. Yes. And I guess the way you could sort of guess that is, you know, you can synthetically make rare earth garnets. Okay. For example. But as you go to the left, things drop off really fast. It crosses CPX. They're about equally compatible for things like zirconium and hafnium, if I'd done it right. And then there's a major negative anomaly here at potassium. So garnet really doesn't like potassium relative to clinopyroxene. Okay, so we put some others on here. Really jiggly, okay? So you see what I mean when I say if we had picked, for example, garnet as the phase to arrange these elements, we would have arranged them quite differently. We would have taken potassium and moved it over here. We would have taken this guy and moved it over here, okay, just to make it smooth. Now that's just a game. So the basic thing you see in this end of the spidergram, where a lot of the parent-daughter isotope systems reside, CPX is the major host, garnet, orthopyroxene, and olivine. As you go probably somewhere over here, when you get below 10 to the minus 4 for partition coefficients, just the experimental problems of measuring that correctly get really enormous. So we have to view, in fact, most of the olivine is a little shaky. In this business, if you're within a factor of 2 to 3, you're pretty happy. Okay, so it's not like measuring something to 1%.
Is it possible that for some of the very incompatible elements that they form their own separate phase?
Yeah, that's an age old. Let's see how to put this. No, because I think the answer is yes. In the old days, okay, before we could do experiments very well, we'd take a peridotite. And we would try to do this naturally, okay? You find a peridotite that has these four phases in it that you think has, for example, something that erupted in a kimberlite from diamond stability depth. So it's really, really hot, blue to the surface, no time for anything to happen to it. So in other words, it was in equilibrium, in phase equilibrium, at very high temperature and then quenched. And so the idea was, well, you could take garnet, CPX, OPX, olivine, and simply separate those and analyze them, and the partitioning between them. Now it wouldn't be mineral melt, it would be mineral, but it would be a good start. Measure the concentration distribution between them and you'd get partitioning. But the problem is, because things don't like olivine, for example, you had to separate the olivine really, really clean. And it turns out the harder you worked at making the olivine clean, the lower this number went. And eventually you could get it so clean that you couldn't measure it anymore. So then people got really worried about, well, what's going on? How, you know, what does it mean to measure this rock? For example, measure potassium in this rock. If as you clean the individual minerals, the potassium goes away. Well, what it means is there's a lot of potassium on grain boundaries. Okay, and that most of the budget of potassium in a peridotite like this does not actually reside in the phases. It resides somewhere on these grain boundaries. And of course, we all thought, well, so whole rock measurements are useless. And then the mineral measurements are useless unless you get them really clean, because this junk on the grain boundaries has been introduced as junk. But then it turns out probably we were throwing away the stuff that was really, that really belonged there. So the question was, will this junk that tends to, and it's mostly this stuff here, tends to congregate on grain boundaries, how does it exist there? You know, does the grain boundary have these odd atoms sitting in it, or does this junk actually get together to make some kind of a funny phase? And I think that's, you know, that's been totally intractable problem until the last few years when Dave Kolstad began to try to look at grain boundaries and to measure the chemistry on a nanometer scale on the grain boundaries, and to try to understand whether there is an organized phase there or whether it truly is just junk. Okay. But it makes a big difference, because if you want to know the bulk earth concentration of, let's say, potassium, and you find a peridotite that has a flat pattern for all of the easy measurable elements, you'd say, well, this looks like chondritic pattern in this peridotite. It's probably pretty primitive. Now we'll measure potassium and get bulk earth potassium. Well, but there's just no way. You get almost any number you want. Okay. So that, I think we're actually about to learn something with these experiments that Dave's doing and other people. It's what we used to just exclude as junk. And still feels like junk, but...
When they're in, when you're looking at xenoliths from kimberlites, like salts, it's possible they're using the original stuff that is really like the
tritium. Oh, I mean, in a kimberlite that's carrying a xenolith, there's every reason to believe that the xenolith has been infiltrated with stuff from the kimberlite, because it's an incredibly aqueous environment. And that was our assumption always, so we just throw that stuff away. But I think we're throwing out the baby with the bathwater sometimes, so to speak. Oh yeah, oh big time. And I mean, in the early days, of course, mostly people would find chondrites. They're called finds. You know, you walk around, you stumble, and when you pick it up, you go, oh, I got a meteorite. It had been lying there in the rain for, you know, 300 years. And those were severely contaminated with stuff that's important to us. So it got to the point where they began to only even bother with falls. So somebody would report a fall, and they'd rush out and pick up the stuff while it was still hot. And that would escape, you know, the superficial terrestrial contamination, more or less successfully.
Is this, maybe I misunderstood, I thought this grain boundary stuff, is that contamination or is that just a...
Well, what I was trying to say is in the early days, we attributed all of this grain boundary stuff to contamination from infiltration from the host magma during eruption. So, you know, we just erase it all. And then you take the constituent minerals, clean them really, really carefully, acid leach them, you know, whatever. And when you did that to olivine, you eventually got it so clean that you couldn't measure anything in it. But you could then, whatever you did measure, you could take the modal abundance of the minerals and add back up what you thought was a pristine rock, which didn't have this grain boundary stuff. But in fact, I think we were throwing out some stuff that belonged there. It was, no, it was Zindler and Yagut's. It was clear to me that this was junk. I would have argued strongly. Okay, we're about time for a break. Am I... Okay, well, 3:15. So let me just pull some of this into what Don was briefly mentioning yesterday. And we'll talk a lot more about these two isotope systems and all the others. But, okay, the basic issue here, sorry, samarium. There are two parent-daughter systems. Samarium decays to 143 neodymium. 144 is just common neodymium. Rubidium decays to strontium 87. Strontium 86 is the common strontium. And what one of the plots that Don showed yesterday was this pretty amazing, what to us would look like an amazing anti-correlation between these two isotope systems. And Don made the point that since we know what chondritic neodymium isotopes are, we think we know what chondritic, what bulk earth neodymium isotopes are, 512638. We have no idea what bulk earth strontium is, okay? And the reason is that rubidium is deficient in the earth relative to chondrites because of this volatility issue. So we truly have no idea what the bulk earth rubidium strontium ratio is like. We in fact calculate the number we use for bulk earth rubidium is backed out by assuming from this a value for bulk earth strontium isotopes and then asking how much rubidium you would need in 4.5 billion years to get there. And then that rubidium is used as the number for bulk earth rubidium. Okay. Does that seem far-fetched? Yeah, I think so. Anyway, my point was simply, why this reverse correlation? Well, you can see right away that here's rubidium and here's strontium, let's say up here. So rubidium's more incompatible than strontium. A melting event will remove rubidium, leaving a rubidium poor environment, which over time will sort of grow a retarded strontium. In other words, the strontium won't grow as fast as it should because it has no rubidium. At the same time, we got samarium here and neodymium. The parent-daughter position on the spidogram is reversed. So neodymium, the daughter, is more incompatible. So when you take a melt and remove it from a solid, you enhance the parent in the residue. And that, over time, grows higher. So melting leaves a residue that ages to low strontium but high neodymium, and then the converse. If you take that melt and put it someplace and look at it much later on, the melt will have high rubidium strontium, which goes this way, and will have low samarium neodymium, which will go this way. And the two are coupled, okay? They're coupled through this spidogram. Insofar as, you know, most peridotite mantle has similar abundances of these phases. And whenever you melt it, leave a residue behind, or look at the melt later on, they're tightly coupled, and they will generate this anti-correlation. And I've exaggerated how good this is, you'll realize if you remember Don's plot. But so, in the early days, everybody was so happy because they take bulk earth neodymium, go over to here, go down to here, and say bulk earth strontium was a number like that. Yeah. know, probably not far off. But those are the kinds of things that we do to find out some of, and we'll talk more about, some of the elements in the earth. How do we know what lead in the bulk earth is? It's one of these incredibly volatile elements. It's depleted 50 times in the earth relative to chondrites. What are we going to use? We have lead here. You know, we plot lead, we divide it by bulk earth lead. Where did we get that from? Well, in the same sort of argument as we have here. We back it out using the isotope values. Okay, I'm actually going to quit there before I start something else. Thank you.